This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. I'm Talia.
And I'm Tanya.
And together we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Tanya.
Hi, Talia.
Welcome back, everybody, to another exciting episode of Crimes and Consequences. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
Good. Well, I have an interesting story, and it was recommended to us by one of our patron members from our Patreon page, patreon.com/TNTCrimes. Her name is Candace D. It was a really good story. She brought it to my attention a few weeks ago, and I wanted to do it. So with that being said, it hasn't been done a lot. And it's pretty controversial.
Let's hear it.
Before I do, I just want to take 1 second to ask everybody to hit the subscribe/follow button on whatever app you're listening to us on. And with that being said, I'm going to start. So picture this. It's just after midnight and it's sweltering out. It's a summer night in August of 1999. And a 911 operator receives this emergency call regarding a young girl at a gas station. That's where the call was placed. Police and firemen were immediately dispatched to a burning brick ranch house at 4600 Campbell Lane. It was a modest home in a small community known as North Smithfield Manor, which is a northern suburb of Birmingham, Alabama, just west of Interstate 65. In Alabama, in the summer, is hot.
Yeah, I've never been there in the summer, but it's hot as hell here.
Yeah, so it's Alabama. It's hot. The house was affixed on the corner of Campbell and Knowles Lane, not far from the fire station and just down the road from the Hayes Chapel Baptist Church. The house isn't in a subdivision. It's on a road, and there are other houses nearby, but they're not very close. Like, everybody seems to have a couple acres because I did some Google Earth satellite images of it. The home had a plush green lawn, and a few large oak trees were scattered throughout it, and it abutted a small patch of woods. This residence was once the pride of 76-year-old DeRoy Knowles, who is a retired steelworker, and his wife, she went by Liz. There they had raised their 8 children and some grandchildren. But now, today, that house stands boarded up and vacant. No one is interested in a place where a family was slaughtered during a bloody rampage. At the time the story takes place, DeRoy and Liz live in this Campbell house with the youngest of their 7 daughters, 30-year-old Millie Rose, and their 2 granddaughters, 10-year-old Mary and 14-year-old Ashley Jones. Now, I really want to share a little bit of the background on Liz and DeRoy because their selfless lives only compound the tragedy that I'm going to tell you about in a minute. The couple were married in 1948 after DeRoy returned home from serving his country in World War II. He received honors for his bravery. Together, the two, they got married. They raised 7 daughters and 1 son. That's a lot of kids.
Damn, it's a lot.
DeRoy earned money as a steel worker to support his family, and then in 1976, he retired. Liz was really an amazing woman. She earned a bachelor's degree in early education from Alabama State at a time when many Black women, especially in the South, weren't expected to go to college and didn't go to college. Liz and DeRoy raised their children in a very religious and loving home. And they instilled hard work and education in them. But God was a main focus for Liz and DeRoy. They were very, very religious. Now, on that August evening in 1999, neighbors driving by found Liz and DeRoy's 10-year-old granddaughter, Mary, staggering down the street. She was drenched in blood, which seemed to be seeping out of countless wounds all over her body. For some reason, and I'm not sure if it's because they didn't have a phone, but they quickly drove the young girl to a nearby gas station where emergency responders were summoned to her grandparents' house. Firefighters and detectives arrived at the Campbell home to find smoke billowing from it. They quickly spotted Grandma Liz sitting slumped over on a lawn chair under an oak tree. And I believe she often sat under the oak tree for some shade and sat outside. Her clothes were smoldering and some of her skin was melting off of her.
Ooh.
Like Mary, Liz was covered with blood and she was clinging to life. Mary had managed to help her grandma stumble out of the burning house, but Liz was just too weak to make it past the yard. Liz, who was a Sunday school superintendent and president of the local missionary society, was barely alive. That's why Mary had her sit in the chair and then Mary trekked alone in the dark to get help. First responders on the scene did their best to stabilize the victims and they were transported to the hospital. An examination of their wounds showed that Mary had been stabbed 14 times, while her 76-year-old grandma had been stabbed, shot, and set afire alive.
Damn.
Firefighters knew there were other Knoll's family members still in that house, and they braved the flames in the hopes of getting to them before they died. But their hopes were quickly dashed when they discovered the deceased body of 76-year-old DeRoy, Grandpa DeRoy, on the floor near the kitchen with a knife protruding from his back. His battered body told the tale of the brutality and torture he had to have endured prior to his death. He was swollen, bruised, and two bullets pierced his face. Stab wounds covered his body, and his body smelled of charcoal lighting fluid. Much of it was covered with third-degree burns. Someone had set this man, who had devoted his life to his family and God, on fire, alive.
Oh.
DeRoy had no enemies. I mean, he was loved through the North Smithfield Manor community. He would often be seen driving around in his bright lime green Cadillac. And he spent most of his spare time at the Hayes Chapel Baptist Church, where he was a deacon. He was also a member of the mission and a trustee on some board. He's just a really great guy. And now he's laying smoldering in his kitchen on the floor. Through the ash and smoke, firefighters made their way down the hall and into the bedroom of 30-year-old Millie Rose Knowles. Millie lived with her parents because she struggled with mental illness. Since her late teens, she had been having issues with it. Specifically schizophrenia, that's what she had. She was diagnosed with schizophrenia. And as you know, Tanya, schizophrenia can be treated but not cured. Although Millie had her shortcomings and she could be difficult to handle, she was very much loved by her whole family. On occasion, she could even be violent, from what I read. And at one point in her life, I'm not sure when, she was admitted into the psychiatric ward of the Bryce Hospital in order to get her symptoms under control. Obviously, her mental illness made it more difficult in the household. But as I said, for the most part, Millie was a very loving young woman. When responders entered her room, the sound of the TV and the light from its screen was a sharp contrast to the still ashen walls. Millie was found face up on her bed, clad in a pink bathrobe. Her bruised and battered body was riveted by gunshots and knife wounds, and of course, she too had been burned. After all the flames had died and the entire house had been searched, there was one family member still unaccounted for, 14-year-old Ashley Jones, DeRoy and Liz's very troubled granddaughter, who was also Mary's older sister. So now I'm going to tell you about Ashley Tamia Jones. She was a difficult young girl. At first glance, this pretty teen seemed like she could cause no harm. She's just this tiny little thing, very petite. She stood about 5 feet tall and weighed a little more than 100 pounds.
Oh, she's tiny.
Tiny. But looks can be deceiving, as we know. She had a juvenile record, and I tried really hard to find it because even though juvenile records are sealed, sometimes they get leaked, but I could not find her juvenile record. And for the most part, so everybody knows, my information came from court memorandums, briefs, and opinions. No matter how much I searched, I couldn't find it. So I'm going to talk to you about Ashley and what happened in her earlier years, but I want everybody to know that I can't verify all of this. Parts of what I'm about to say are only alleged. And some of that is only a result of Ashley's statements, which can be very self-serving. As a young child, Ashley had a speech impediment. And of course, kids are assholes.
Yeah, they're assholes.
They made fun of her. Her parents were married and they had a volatile relationship in which her father allegedly abused her mother, whose name was Camria. She worked as an RN at the local Birmingham hospital. There were accusations that she suffered from substance abuse issues. And according to Ashley, she would frequently bring little Ashley to crack houses.
So she wasn't the child of Millie Rose?
No, she is the child of one of Liz and DeRoy's middle daughters, Camria. Around the age of 5, Ashley allegedly witnessed her biological father holding her mother and baby Mary at gunpoint. He apparently then fired a bullet into the family car. Eventually, Ashley's parents divorced, and Ashley's mother ended up marrying a man. And Ashley would later accuse him, much further down the line, of sexually abusing her. Ashley never really fit in at school, and she didn't have many friends. At the age of 10, she attempted her first suicide by jumping out of a window, which resulted in a few minor injuries. I mean, that's 10 years old.
That's crazy.
At 11, she intentionally overdosed on pills, which resulted in seizures, and she had to be taken to the hospital. When she was 13, she tried to OD once again on pills and was admitted into the Birmingham Children's Hospital. Now, advocates for Ashley paint a picture of a young girl who suffered extreme abuse and neglect. And this may well be true. I have no doubt her environment was unstable. I just don't know the true extent of it because, again, to reiterate, this is also very self-serving to Ashley, as you'll see later in the story. Now I want to bring you to the beginning of 1999, before the fire, before Ashley and Mary ended up living with her grandparents. They would spend their time between their mom and their dad's house. One time while staying at her father's house, Ashley stabbed her father in the chest.
What?
She was 13. She later said she did it to protect herself and her little sister Mary and said that she was aiming for his heart.
Wow, for a 13-year-old?
That's pretty hardcore.
Right.
According to the only news article I used as a source, it's called TVCrimeSky.com, which, by the way, is a great website. It was shortly after she stabbed her father that Ashley got into an argument with her mother, and her mother was pregnant at the time. They got into a fight over a red jacket, and Ashley stabbed her mother.
Her pregnant mom.
Her pregnant mom. So she has stabbed both of her parents in the first 2 months of 1999. Ashley was sent to the juvenile home, where she remained from March until June. When she was released into the custody of DeRoy and Liz. DeRoy and Liz couldn't bear the thought of Ashley entering the foster care system, and her parents were none too eager to have her return to their home. For reasons unknown to me, Mary ended up moving in with her grandparents too, probably as a result of the chaotic home life. Unlike Ashley, Mary was a well-adjusted child who caused no grievances for her family, even though she was raised in the same environment as her sister. During this time while they were living with her grandparents, based on court records, both the girls frequently saw their mother still, so it's not like they didn't have contact with their parents. And DeRoy and Liz's house, being that they had 8 children, was always filled with aunts, uncles, cousins. There was a lot going on. Liz and DeRoy hoped that by giving Ashley a stable environment with God as the focus, they could somehow save her from this destructive path she was on. But they were wrong. Ashley refused to follow the rules. She had no respect for her grandparents. And DeRoy confessed to members of his congregation that he feared what his young granddaughter was capable of. He believed she was dangerous. And he and Liz, they didn't know had to help her, and they pretty much lost all hope of helping her. To make matters worse, 13-year-old Ashley was dating the bad boy of the neighborhood.
Oh, boy.
Right? You knew it. You knew there had to be some bad boy. His name was Jeremy Hart, and he was 15 years old. Ashley met Jeremy at a party in the winter of 1998. So this is before the stabbings of the parents. And she quickly became enamored with him.
Of course.
She thought he was, quote, cute and not fake, like all the other boys. And Jeremy was equally infatuated with Ashley. Jeremy had only recently moved into his Aunt Iris's home that was just a little bit down the road from the Knolls. And I want to point out something that I just realized in telling you this. I'm talking about the Knolls family, and they live on Knolls Lane.
Really?
Campbell and Knolls Lane.
Oh.
I don't know.
Maybe they're a big family in the area.
I don't know. Well, we know that. They had 8 children.
That's true.
Jeremy was trying to get away from the gang life in Birmingham, and his Aunt Iris thought she could give him a more stable environment than what he had going on with his mom. She enrolled him in the Gardendale High School, and it was the same school that Ashley went to. At the school, he was deemed to be sort of a bully, who often bragged about, falsely, that he was a member of a gang.
Oh.
He wasn't a member of a gang, but he thought it'd be cool to have that persona.
Sure.
He really wanted to have this badass persona. And he had gotten in a little bit of trouble, but he wasn't really this, like, gangster kind of kid. He was just more of a wannabe.
Talk is big.
Yes. And Ashley liked that. The two did what teens do. They talked on the phone for hours, sharing their intimate teen secrets with each other. They would often sneak out in the middle of the night to see each other. I mean, why not?
I know.
Just down the road, absolutely. I don't know if it's true, but Jeremy told Ashley that he had a baby and a baby mama. But I never found anything that said he actually had a child. I mean, he's only 15, but he could. In February of 1999, after a few months of dating, the 13-year-old and the 15-year-old consummated their love.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And this was just shortly before she ended up going to the juvenile home. Being sent to the juvenile home didn't stop the two teens from being together. They wrote letters to each other. And as soon as she was released in June, they continued seeing each other against Ashley's grandparents' orders. DeRoy was so unhappy with this relationship that he would often call the police on Jeremy in an effort to keep them apart. I don't know the crime Jeremy's committing, but he called the police a lot.
Oh, he's forbidden now. Just makes him all the more attractive.
That is exactly what I was just going to say. By trying to keep two teens away from each other, you only end up making them want each other more.
Mm-hmm.
The forbidden fruit.
The forbidden fruit.
In DeRoy and Liz's defense, I mean, Ashley's only 13. Neither one of them thought she was even old enough to date. I mean, she's 13. Ashley resented living with her strict religious grandparents and her mentally ill Aunt Millie. And I mentioned earlier that Aunt Millie would occasionally have violent outbursts. Allegedly, on one occasion, she tried to throw scalding hot water on Ashley and Mary, but she missed. So there's a lot of chaos going on in the Knolls home. And it's so sad because they're just like these sweet grandparents.
I know, they sounded like lovely people.
And it's got all this shit happening in their house. A new school year started in August of 1999, and within a few weeks, Ashley had already skipped days to hang out with Jeremy. Jeremy wasn't allowed to attend school because that wasn't really his proper school district. They found out he's living with his aunt, and they're like, no.
But weren't they in the same neighborhood?
They were, but technically his mom, it went by his mom's address because the aunt didn't have custody of him.
Got it. That makes a lot of sense.
A week prior to the murders, Ashley was kicked out of school for starting a physical confrontation with a girl over what I don't know, but I guarantee it's something stupid. At this same time, Camria, Ashley's mother, had filed to retain custody of her daughter. She wanted Ashley back in her house. Ashley overheard a conversation between her grandparents in which they agreed they were ready for her to leave.
Oh, boy.
Whether it meant her returning to her mom's home or entering the foster care system, they couldn't handle her any longer. And Ashley knew if she was sent back to live with her mom, it would be really hard for her to see Jeremy. Her mom lived farther away, and neither one of these teens had a car. Jeremy casually mentioned during a conversation that they could maybe kill Ashley's family, steal her grandpa's Cadillac.
That bright green Cadillac?
Yes. And live out their lives in Mexico.
Oh, that's a great plan.
Absolutely. Ashley considered it, but no formal plans were put in place. But then an event on August 27th got the wheels moving, and the murderous plot to kill the Nalls began. August 27th was a Friday, and Ashley snuck out. She wanted to go to a party, and I'm not sure why, but Jeremy wasn't there. He had spoken with Ashley at some point, and this is all a little bit fuzzy. There's not a lot of detail about what happened. And Ashley claimed to have been kidnapped by some gang members at the party.
Okay, we'll go with that.
Jeremy was so concerned for her safety that he felt he had no choice but to reach out to DeRoy and Liz. And you know, like, he must have really been worried because DeRoy and Liz can't stand him. But hours later, Ashley just sort of showed up at her grandparents' home.
I'm home.
She told them she'd been abducted by gang members who had abused her. But they didn't believe her wild story. And I'm assuming she wasn't battered and she didn't have any obvious signs of abuse. Otherwise, I'm sure they would have done something about it. So they grounded her. And you can't really fault them because Ashley's lied to them over and over again. And that's a pretty wild tale. I mean, that's some shit I probably would have made up back in the day when I was out at a party all night. They were livid and forbid her from leaving the house, which really pissed Ashley off. She would later claim that that anger just grew in her because she felt they should have taken her seriously when she said she was abducted by the gang, and they should have had her checked out by a doctor. So maybe she was making allegations of being abducted and raped. I don't know exactly. I'm speculating. Anyway, that is when Jeremy and Ashley decided her family absolutely had to die. For 2 days, they formulated their plan to ensure that nothing could keep these lovers apart ever again. That night, while watching an episode of Melrose Place.
I used to love Melrose Place.
Well, so did Ashley. Ashley came up with the idea of setting her grandparents' house on fire to destroy all the evidence. So there must have been some sort of home burning in Melrose Place.
Had to be.
The next day was Sunday, and that's the day of reckoning. As I said, it was a sweltering 95 degrees outside. I know, I looked it up on Google to see what the weather was like August 29th of 1999.
It's 100% humidity out there.
Right. It was 95 degrees. But as the evening came and the sun went down, everyone settled in for the night. And for those that want to know, at the time the story takes place, it's 83 degrees.
I was going to say, when did it go down to 88?
Because I'm such a dork. I have to look this stuff up.
It was hot and sticky.
Yeah, it's hot as hell. As each family member prepared for bed, Ashley prepared for murder. She made this cocktail of nail polish, rubbing alcohol, and charcoal starter fluid in the anticipation of setting the house ablaze. She packed a bag with all her toiletries and clothes, and then she called Jeremy. But before I tell you the really horrific events, and I have all the details of what happened that night, we're going to take a quick break. Late in the evening on August 29th, DeRoy sat in the den and he was watching TV. Millie brushed her teeth. She put the TV on in her room and she laid in bed. 10-year-old Mary quickly had fallen asleep in the back bedroom. That's where she slept. She had school the next morning. And Liz drifted off to bed in the master bedroom. When everyone seemed to settle in for the night, Ashley called Jeremy, telling him it was time. Jeremy had been nagging his Aunt Iris for hours to let him stay the night at his cousin's. She hesitated, but eventually she acquiesced and watched as he walked out the door. Jeremy didn't respect a lot of people or things, but he'd always showed Iris reverence to her, and she trusted him. He had promised he wouldn't see Ashley anymore. Grandpa and Grandma Knowles had called her and been like, you know, keep them away. It was roughly 11:15 when Ashley let him in to the house. He wore a red bandana over his lower face, and he was armed with DeRoy's .38 Colt Cobra revolver. Ashley had stolen it from her grandfather's home the day before and given it to Jeremy for the sole purpose of killing her family. Once inside the house, Ashley led Jeremy to the den where DeRoy sat on his lazy boy chair, chilling, watching TV. Without saying a word, Jeremy shot the 76-year-old grandfather twice in the face. And believing he was dead, both the teens made their way down the hallway into Millie's room. The gunfire had awakened Millie, and she sat up in her bed. But before she had time to react, Jeremy pointed the .38 at her, and he shot her 3 times. Like her father, this didn't kill her. But Jeremy and Ashley thought she was dead. So they left that room, and they made their way towards the master bedroom. They only had one bullet left in the chamber, and this bullet was meant for Grandma Liz. The commotion had startled Liz awake. She'd placed one foot on the floor as she was trying to get out of bed, but before she could even put her second foot on the floor, Jeremy pointed the gun at her, aiming for her heart, and he shot it. But luckily for Liz, it only pierced her shoulder. Though it was in her chest, so it might look from where Jeremy and Ashley, who was right next to him, by the way, it might look to them like Grandma had been shot in the heart. Hearing noises near the kitchen, the teens ran to see what was going on. Even though DeRoy had 2 bullet wounds to his face, he had managed to stumble from the den towards the kitchen, which was only feet away, and it sounds like it's almost a little bit of an open floor plan. I don't know for sure, but the den and the kitchen are very near each other. It's believed he was trying to get to the phone that was on the kitchen wall to call for help. The teens grabbed the nearest objects, and they began beating the elderly man. One had a vase, and the other had an umbrella. Then, using a knife from the kitchen, they took turns repeatedly stabbing him. Jeremy leaned in towards DeRoy, and he said, quote, "You won't be calling the police on me no more. You won't be calling the police," end quote. And then with that, he stabbed the elderly man in the neck. Ashley stabbed her grandpa in the back and left the knife there. But DeRoy wasn't dead.
Oh, shit.
He still managed to survive this.
That is crazy.
Now, a wounded Liz stumbled toward her dying husband. She's getting out of the master bedroom and stumbling towards the kitchen. Although Jeremy was wearing that red bandana over his lower face, and I'm not sure how he could possibly think that Liz isn't going to recognize him, seeing that her granddaughter is helping this guy
right.
attack her family.
I thought that. I'm like, this is so dumb.
Liz did recognize him, and she called out his name, and he answered back to her. All of this violence aroused little Mary, who was sleeping in the back bedroom. She ran out towards the kitchen to see what was going on, and she saw her grandparents being brutalized. She tried to run away, but Ashley grabbed her by the arm and told her to, quote, "sit down and chill." Little Mary watched in horror as her sister and Jeremy stabbed her grandma in the shoulder and the breast. Then Ashley found an ice pick and jammed it into her grandma's jaw.
Oh, my God.
As DeRoy lay dying on the floor, Ashley and Jeremy, now keep in mind, he's got the knife in his back and he's been stabbed in the neck. He's been shot. He's been beaten. Jeremy and Ashley demanded he tell them where he kept his money. My guess is that DeRoy thought if he told them, maybe they would have some mercy on him or his family. So he said the money was in the master bedroom under the mattress. And there they found $300 cash.
A whopping $300.
After being told where the money is, the teens decided it was time to finish off their victims. Again, little Mary's just forced to watch as Jeremy opened a can of charcoal lighter fluid and Ashley doused her grandmother with it. Ashley then took a match and threw it on the elderly woman. Ashley and Jeremy stood over Liz as she burned, arguing whether Ashley should pour some of the concoction she had made over Liz to increase the flames.
Jeez.
So they're literally watching Liz burn and arguing if that's enough
fire.
Fire. And decided it wasn't. Mary can just only stare as her grandma is just being burned in front of her. Ashley ended up pouring nail polish remover, rubbing alcohol, and that lighter fluid all over her grandmother. And as I said, watched her burn, watched the flames get higher and hotter. DeRoy, he's still alive. He's still conscious. And they douse him with that concoction too, and they set him alight. Ashley then went into her Aunt Millie's room to make sure she was dead. And to her surprise, Millie was still alive. Using a knife from the kitchen, Ashley stabbed Millie in the chest. Then she stabbed her again, 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 and yet again for a total of 9 times. Millie was coughing up blood.
Ugh.
Ashley grabbed an electric heater. It was like a portable little heater. Ashley took one of the heaters, Millie had two, and repeatedly hit her aunt over the head. Then she threw one of the heaters on top of her aunt's body, picked up another heater, and did the same thing again, leaving the heaters on top of Millie's body. Then she used an accelerant and a match, and they together, Jeremy and Ashley, lit Millie's room on fire with her in it. Mary, shocked, stunned, watched as her grandparents were smoldering on the floor, her grandfather with his knife embedded in his back, her grandmother only a few feet away, burning, screaming in pain. Mary knew her sister and Jeremy, they weren't going to let her live through this. I mean, she's a witness.
Right, a smart 10-year-old right there.
So she tries to flee. Ashley gave chase and quickly caught up with her little sister. She began punching her sister with her fists. Then Jeremy intervened. He grabbed Mary by the neck, and he held a second gun, another one of DeRoy's guns that he had, to Mary's head. And he said to the little girl, quote, "This is how you're gonna die."
Oh, my God.
Ashley interrupted him, not to save her little sister. Instead, she said, quote, "No, let me do it."
Oh, my God.
Isn't that horrible?
Yes.
And with a knife, a butcher knife that she'd gotten from her grandparents' kitchen drawer, she stabbed her baby sister 14 times.
Jeez.
And as you pointed out, Mary's a very smart little girl. She collapsed to the ground and lay silently in the fetal position, playing dead, hoping that they will just leave her alone.
And not set her on fire.
Right. And they didn't. They thought she was dead. Believing they had successfully annihilated Ashley's family, Jeremy and Ashley went about setting the entire house on fire. They piled sheets, towels, and paper on the floor and then drenched that pile with an accelerant. So they probably just thought that Mary will burn up in that fire. Elated and with cash in hand, the couple hopped into DeRoy's lime green Cadillac and drove off.
Not conspicuous at all.
That's literally the word I have used in this. Literally, I have a line in here somewhere that says exactly that. So thanks for spoiling it.
Hello. It's not just a gray Cadillac or something that there's hundreds of them on the road.
And I bet it's an old school kind of Cadillac, mm-hmm. One of those big ones. That's my guess. Mary, suffering from a collapsed lung and 14 Ooh. Stab wounds, struggled to her feet. She mustered the strength to go to her grandma. By this time, Liz's flames had died down, but she was still smoldering. And, you know, blood was everywhere from the gunshot wounds and the stab wounds. Mary helped her grandmother up, and Liz managed to walk out of her home, which was now ablaze. It must have been, I was thinking about this, so heartbreaking for her to leave her husband of 50 years dead on the floor and her daughter in that bedroom. And then, as you know from me telling the story, Liz was just too weak to make it past her front yard and collapsed in that lawn chair under a large tree. But fearless Mary ran down that dark street towards a neighbor's house, and you know the rest of that. Meanwhile, Jeremy and Ashley picked up a friend of theirs. Her name was Regina Hayes, and she was 23 years old. Regina rented a hotel room for them in a seedy area of Birmingham because they were too young, obviously, to rent their own room. And of course, you can probably imagine what the first thing the teens did when they got to that room was. They had sex. Eventually, Ashley took a shower. A little while later, Regina came back with Jeremy's cousin, DeAndre Riley, and they all partied for a while.
What is a 23-year-old doing being friends with a 15 and a 13-year-old?
Well, I believe she was a girlfriend of DeAndre, who happens to be Jeremy's cousin.
Okay, so that makes sense.
By the next morning, the murders were all over the news. And a bolo, be on the lookout for DeRoy's Cadillac, was issued. As you can guess, it did not take long for them to spot the lime green Cadillac in the parking lot of that seedy motel. As Ashley and Jeremy were watching the news, they were shocked to find out that both Mary and Liz had survived. And in regards to young Mary surviving, Ashley stated in a joking manner to Jeremy, quote, "I thought I killed that bitch," end quote.
Damn.
And that makes me wonder if she really stabbed her father in the chest earlier that year to protect her sister Mary and herself.
That's a good point.
Because she seems to not have any protective instinct whatsoever anymore or any regard for her sister. And here's the line I was telling you about. Obviously, the lime green Cadillac was pretty conspicuous and someone tipped off the police. So they go to the hotel and by mid-morning, the couple was taken into custody. At the police station, the teens were separated, and eventually both of them confessed to the murders. During Ashley's confession, she broke down and began crying.
Oh, give me a fucking break.
She said, quote, "Everybody in the house was kind of going crazy, and everybody just didn't get along, and I didn't get along with anybody, and we just killed them."
Okay.
She then pleaded with the detectives to tell Jeremy how much she loved him.
Oh, gross.
And how sorry she was that she put him in this situation. And later on, the medical examiner would testify that both victims suffered greatly.
Aww.
Prior to succumbing to their injuries, with DeRoy, as you know, still conscious when he was set afire. Little Mary was treated for her 14 stab wounds inflicted by her older sister. She ended up having a chest tube inserted into her collapsed lung to help her breathe. It was Grandma Liz that really had the worst of the two surviving victims. She was in critical condition and she ended up being placed in a coma for 30 days.
Wow.
35% of her body sustained burns. And of course, the gunshot and the stab wounds. She ended up having to undergo multiple skin grafts and extensive rehabilitative therapy. But no matter how much therapy she had, she still couldn't really use her arms because the skin grafts and stuff, the skin just the way it was. She was never able to drive again and didn't have the full use of her arms. She also bared a scar on her forehead. Her skin was white from where it was lit on fire. Even though we're both lawyers, I often don't like to discuss the trials too much. Because I think most people don't enjoy it as much as perhaps you and I might. But this trial's in the aftermath of the murder is pretty interesting. And that's where the controversy I mentioned earlier comes into play. Both teens were denied what was called the youthful offender status, which means they were tried as adults. And Ashley's trial commenced first in 2001. Both Grandma Liz and Sister Mary testified against her. Ashley's attorneys had hoped to argue that she was mentally ill at the time of the murders.
Stop it.
And a psychiatrist had diagnosed her as suffering from PTSD, chronic and severe depression, paranoia, and possibly maybe signs of impending schizophrenia.
Okay.
Compared to a lot of the offenders, that's really pretty mild. But you and I both know that the legal standard under the law for insanity is the McNaughton test. The McNaughton test presumes that all defendants are sane unless it can be proven that at the time of committing the criminal act, the defendant's state of mind caused them to really not know what they were doing was wrong.
That's a pretty high standard to meet.
Yeah. I mean, I'm summarizing the McNaughton test. And Ashley clearly knew what she was doing was wrong. During the trial, Ashley read magazines and sucked her thumb.
I'm not even going to say anything.
And Liz made a comment saying that the devil just got in her. That's her comment in regards to maybe why Ashley did that. After Grandma Liz testified, she walked over to Ashley and gave her a big hug.
Did she really?
I know, she's a freaking saint.
She is.
Ashley stated, quote, "I just say it happened. I don't know the reason for real. I just lost touch with reality. When all that was happening, it wasn't me. I feel like something possessed me," end quote.
Watching too much Melrose Place.
Well, I'm thinking something possessed her for a couple days. It wasn't a crime of like a heat of passion kind of thing. It was premeditated for 2 days. In an interview with the Birmingham News, Ashley said, quote, "I'm not as bad a person as everyone thinks. I mean, they portray me as the devil or something, which is untrue," end quote. On March 2nd, in 2001, the jury found Ashley guilty on 2 counts of first-degree capital murder. Now, in Alabama, first-degree capital murder has a mandatory sentence of either death or life in prison with no parole. Prior to her sentencing hearing, Ashley got in trouble in jail.
Girl.
She threatened another Jefferson County inmate, telling this inmate, "I'll do to you what I did to my family."
Way to go.
And this didn't sit well with the judge, Judge Gloria Bajacal. So I told you the crimes and I hinted at the consequences. The judge was pretty upset. She said at the sentencing hearing, Ashley, quote, "did not express genuine remorse for her actions. Although she apologized at the prompting of the court, her words were hollow and insincere," end quote. Ashley stood before the court with her mother and grandmother beside her as she was handed down 2 consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. And that was the moment, the very first and only moment, she shed any tear during her entire trial.
For herself.
Yeah. Yes. After the verdict, Mary stated, quote, "I hate what happened. I'm moving from home to home. I wish things could be the same again. I wish this never happened," end quote.
Poor Mary.
She ended up visiting and writing to Ashley since the incarceration. And in a Reuters interview 10 years after the murders, when Mary was almost 20, Mary stated in regard to her sister Ashley, quote, "She should have a chance to have a life. Her life shouldn't be taken away from her like that. Sometimes I'm kind of mad, and then I'm sad. I practically lost her, too, because she's in prison," end quote. Very forgiving.
Mm-hmm.
Since being sent to prison, Ashley has earned a diploma and has moved to the honor block of the Tutwiler prison as a result of her model behavior. So, in 2007, Liz was supporting what's called the Equal Justice Initiative, and that is all in regards to juvenile offenders and life without the chance of parole.
For juvenile offenders.
She was advocating that Ashley should have a chance at redemption. She didn't believe that Ashley should just not have served any time, but she felt that 15 to 20 years would have been good and that most juveniles deserve a chance at life. However, the prosecutor in this case, her name was Laura Poston. She said, listen, I don't think every 14-year-old that murders someone should be sent to prison for life. But in this case, Ashley planned it and premeditated it. She wanted 4 people to die. And it's just too much of a risk for the public. She said, between the ages of 2 and 3, you develop a conscience. But Ashley never got that voice. She never got the voice that says, this is bad, Ashley. So that was her take on it. Liz died on December 19th, 2015, at the age of 89.
Wow, bless her heart.
Mary is now an adult and has changed her name, my guess, in a bid to get away from her past that no doubt still haunts her. Through the years, the Supreme Court has addressed the issue of juvenile offenders. And in 2005, they decided it was cruel and unusual for a juvenile to be sentenced to death. I'm not going to get all political and all that, but I mean, like, you know, it's kind of a harsh.
It is.
14, kind of harsh to be sentenced to death. Like, anyway.
What happened to Jeremy?
I haven't gotten there.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I'm not done. It was a Roper case in 2005 that ended death sentence for juveniles. And then in 2010, I believe it is, there was a case called Miller versus the state of Alabama. And in that case, and I'm not trying to bore you, but it is important. The Supreme Court ruled that mandatory life in prison with no chance of parole was cruel and unusual for a juvenile and a violation of the Eighth Amendment. They didn't rule, and a lot of people are confused about this, they didn't rule that life in prison without parole was cruel and unusual, but mandatory sentences, which is what is exactly happened in this case, was cruel and unusual. They believed that it should be looked at a case-by-case basis. That being said, I spent way too much time trying to figure out what Alabama's doing with these juveniles because the ruling was made retroactive. Now, you want to know what happened to Jeremy?
Yes. What happened to Jeremy?
Jeremy Raquel Hart. He was sentenced to life in prison without the chance of parole, and he's currently serving his time at William E. Donaldson Medium Correctional Facility. He's never eligible for parole. Now, this is what's really interesting to me. Ashley is now in a medium security prison, and she has a lot of advocates. As I was saying, there's a lot of advocates that really want her to be able to get paroled. And I'm not saying one way or other how I feel, but they are saying that her offense cannot be accurately understood without acknowledging that it arose out of a traumatized, mentally ill 14-year-old girl's attempt to escape her abusive and violent household. They argue accurately that a teen's brain isn't fully developed. However,
she wasn't abused at the grandparents' house.
You keep doing these spoilers. That's what I was going to say. She wasn't being abused at her grandparents' house, and she clearly did it to be with her boyfriend. To me, what is very interesting is that no one seems to be advocating for Jeremy.
That's what I was thinking.
And he was only a year and a half older than Ashley, and he came from a very tumultuous background, too, and nobody seems to give a flying fuck about Jeremy. Nobody's advocating for him.
He was a juvenile, too.
And part of me wonders if it's because he's a male.
Possibly.
And she's a small, petite girl. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of, because he had just turned 16 only 2 weeks before the murder. So it's not like he was 20 years old. I had stated earlier when I talked about Ashley's background that I didn't know what was true and what wasn't. And the reason why I say that, it could all very well be true. The reason why I say that is because if an argument can be made that she's mentally ill and suffered severe abuse, then at a resentencing, that would be considered and that would help with the leniency. That being said, I'm a huge fan of the Equal Justice Initiative. I know I don't sound like it, but I am. I mentioned that Ashley was in this medium security prison in Tutwiler, I think it's called. When I looked at that page, the inmate page, it said something that I thought was really interesting. It said her minimum release date is December 31st of the year 9,999.
Damn.
But it said she was eligible for parole on December 1st of 2029. I searched everywhere to see if she'd been resentenced, and I couldn't find anything. So I don't know if it was an error. I don't know what. But if anybody knows, email us at contact@crimesandconsequences.com. That is the story of Ashley Jones and the murder of the Knowles family.
Well, I'm conflicted.
Yeah, you know how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
We're just going to keep it to ourselves.
Yeah, so that is a really, really sad story, though. I mean, her grandparents sounded like lovely people. I mean, they were just trying to give her structure, probably.
Yes, absolutely.
And some religion and, you know, but
whip her into shape.
Yes.
I will say something, though. I've always been very, very much for redemption. I'm the bleeding heart when it comes to that.
I can't believe this.
Which is just shocking. Just shocking. I'm not going to say how I feel about Ashley, but there was one case that you and I did on a Patreon, and he was a juvenile. I don't remember his name, but he ended up doing things to a corpse and making a YouTube channel. And I was like, no, no, this guy can never get out. Like, he's doing that shit now at like 15. I don't want to know what the shit he'd be doing later. And I was like, no, no redemption for him. But that's all I'm going to say about it. I want to thank all of you guys for taking the time to listen to this episode. And if you haven't done so already, hit that little subscribe or follow button, whatever it is. If you like the story and you like Tanya and I and you want to get a little bit more grittier, a little more foul mouth, check us out on patreon.com/TNT Crimes, or you can go to our website, crimesandconsequences.com, where we have over 100 exclusive episodes for people that become members. You can also look at our Apple channel and you can find all those episodes too and become an Apple podcast channel subscriber. Is that it? Something like that. Check us out on our social media, Facebook and Instagram. It's at Hardcore True Crime. Again, I got most of my stuff from the court and I did use a New York Times article and the other sources I mentioned earlier.
Well, thanks, Talia.
That's it.
That's it. Until our next episode.
Don't kill each other.
Bye. Bye.